Now, let's look specifically at a practical way to develop one's conscience. Just envision different sets of hands. Think of the hands of a great surgeon, a person who has tremendous dexterity and ability to do heart surgery or brain surgery or surgery on the eye or anything else that requires very delicate movement. Imagine the level of education and training that has gone into those hands. The relationship of the muscles, the nervous system, up into the brain, the knowledge that the brain had to have to know what to do, the knowledge of the physiology, what to do if something happens. You could train someone to do a procedure excellently, even perhaps better than you. That person has to have tremendous knowledge. Think of the education. To educate one's conscience requires all of that and more. You have to really train your conscience to be very sensitive and to listen to it, to respond to it, to obey it. You have to get into the wisdom literature so that you have nurtured the wisdom it contains inside your conscience. You have to do it regularly, systematically, carefully. You have to ponder it, think, meditate on it deeply, so that it becomes part of the way that your conscience has. Just like that surgeon had to learn the whole physiology of the body and the physiology of the surgery processes and all that can happen. Think of another set of hands, a great concert pianist who literally can enthrall audiences. But look at the preparation. Look at the hours and hours of grueling, disciplined, self-sacrificing work, not just hours, but literally years, decades. Some of these great concert pianists, see, and what they're able to do, similarly with the conscience. Because the conscience is the more fuller part of our whole character than a particular skill. A skill may take years, but a conscience takes a lifetime. A skill may take part of your life, but a conscience involves the totality of your life. Every dimension. As Gandhi put it, a person cannot do right in one department of life whilst attempting to do wrong in another department. Life is one indivisible whole. Listen to John Sloan Dickey as he describes the purpose of education. It's a beautiful expression. The end of education is to see men made whole, both in competence and in conscience. For to create the power of competence without creating a corresponding direction to guide the use of that power is bad education. See, if you have competency but no conscience, how are you going to use that competency? That's bad education. There's no wisdom there. And then he finally adds, furthermore, competence will finally disintegrate apart from conscience. I have a son-in-law who was applying to medical school, had many interviews. One of the interviewers asked him this question. Who would you prefer, a first-rate surgeon who was dishonest or a second-rate surgeon who was honest? I thought that my son-in-law, Matt, gave an excellent answer. He said it depends on the issue. If the issue is that I really need the surgery, I'd go for the first-rate surgeon. If the issue is whether I should have the surgery or not, I'd go for the honest one. Now, of course, we want them both. And when we talk about the first condition of empowerment, we talk about trustworthiness, which is a combination of both character and competence. And the nervous system, the respiratory and circulatory system of character is conscience. So the essence, I suggest, to developing our conscience, this unique endowment, is to educate it and to obey it, to respond to its dictates. Educating it alone, without obeying it, will gradually undermine the motivation for the continued education, or it will cause a compartmentalization to come, and a person will be a hypocrite and lead two lives, walk east and west at the same time. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. The opposite is also the case. You could perhaps cultivate the conscience, the character, but what if a person has not paid the price in maintaining currency with the real world, in maintaining a professional development posture in coping with the changing realities of the world? The best intentions will never compensate for bad judgment. Both are absolutely necessary. Each is necessary but insufficient. As they overlap, you have wisdom and judgment, character and competence. Therefore, I would recommend the habit of regularly studying the wisdom literature of your tradition and of learning to be still, to be quiet, to pause in the space, and to listen to your conscience, and then to have the courage to act on the basis of it, to act with true integrity. This is what we mean by exercising integrity in the moment of choice. That space is the area of choice. When the choices are to come up, that's where you exercise integrity. You draw upon your conscience. As you continue to obey your conscience that is educated in the wisdom literature, which contains the generic basic root principles of true permanent success, effectiveness in life, then little by little, your conscience is more and more educated. If you do not educate your conscience will get educated by the social mores of society, and you gradually develop a conscience in that the wrong isn't getting caught. You'll lose the deep moral sense. You'll lose the power of internal self-change. So both are necessary, educating and obeying. One without the other is insufficient. Many people have a very strong social conscience. They have like social radar. They can read what's happening. They scan their environment. They know what's appropriate. But if they haven't educated their conscience in the wisdom literature, they may not be tied to a deep sense of morality, of what is right independent of what is known, what is appropriate, what is socially approved. This is an extremely important point. Just like the body needs constant nourishment, the spirit does also. The heart does. The mind does. Constant nourishment. I can't go more than a day, more than just missing two or three meals, and I feel the weakness of that. None of us can go more than a day or two without nourishing the spirit within us in this wisdom literature, in the principles that have become the foundation of all enduring progress in civilization, of all traditions, nations, cultures, and religions. We must discipline our life to do that. Then the higher discipline is to exercise the independent will to act upon it. You'd also notice that you're using self-awareness, and you'll also notice that you're using your imagination because you have to create what your response is going to be in different circumstances before those circumstances arise. Now, with regard to the education of the imagination, I suggest having the practice of visualizing. The conscious mind is very powerful in its capacity to program the subconscious mind. You'll find that if you can create any situation in your mind in sufficient detail, and then see yourself in that situation, handling it according to your conscience, according to that which is right, to your highest competency, and you essentially tap into all of your feelings, your perceptions, all of the senses of your body as deeply and as powerfully as possible, it's as if you'd already almost done it. The subconscious mind cannot distinguish between an imagined and a real experience. And if you can plant that through a quiet meditative affirmation process, as long as it is guided by conscience, by the deep moral principles of humanity and morality, you have created an engine within yourself and your present circumstance that will enable you to move anywhere else you want. You can live in another environment. You can live in the past. You can live in the future. You can create a better response to your child. You can overcome the weaknesses of your own childhood from going into the next child. Vision is greater than baggage. The future becomes, therefore, greater than our history, and the future is made present through the power of imagination. So, to affirm and envision scenes that tap into your conscience and improve situations, I suggest, should be one of the most fundamental habits of our lives. And the more we do it and act on it, the more our creative imagination capacities are cultivated. Almost every truly great athlete does this. They see it in their mind's eye first. They dress rehearse. The heart of the positive mental thinking field is based upon this. And I think it has a great deal to contribute as long as it is also based upon conscience, principles, so that you don't end up, in a sense, manipulating other people toward your own ends through the power of learning these mental technologies. That becomes the key qualifier. That's why it's so important to have conscience and imagination work together. Evil people have powerful imaginations, but no conscience. They may have great willpower. The best way I know to develop willpower is to make and keep promises. I'll never forget one man who was totally a flake. He was a product of all of the fickle forces that played upon his life. If he was tired, he'd sleep. If he was in the middle of a meeting and he was tired, he'd just fall asleep. If he was hungry, he'd eat. He'd eat whatever was in front of him. He had no criteria as to what was right to eat. He couldn't deny himself anything. If he felt upset and angry at somebody, he'd express it. He called it being honest, being authentic. He would justify it in his own mind. He didn't even have the discipline of mind to consider altogether other categories of thought, such as what is right, what is appropriate. In other words, he was just kind of like a blob that just moves whichever way the environment and the pressures exist. And he had responsibility to accomplish worthy purposes. And he always was having problems with other people. And he came to me again and again, and I would give him counsel about how he should really try to listen to other people more fully and how he should try to show respect and kindness, and he'd resolve right in front of me, and then he'd leave and go forth deeply resolved and excited about it. He'd get outside, and then some little ticky-tacky thing would upset him, and he'd lose his temper and explode, and then he'd realize, oh, what have I done? I just committed myself to do this, and now I've done the opposite. So he began to lose confidence and faith in his own ability to change himself. He'd keep coming back, and I'd keep counseling him. And he would accept the counsel. He was a very willing, open student, but he had no will, no discipline. And then I started to realize, I'm trying to teach him emotional calculus. He's never even learned basic emotional math. So one day I said to him, I think we're going about this the wrong way. Don't worry about being kind and respectful. Will you just get up in the morning at a certain time? And he said, well, what's that got to do with it? And I said, well, you don't yet have control over the body. You'll notice that your passions and your emotions are expressed through your body. If you can get control of your body, of your basic appetites, you can start to move to control your passions and your emotions, and ultimately, the very desires and motives of your life. It appealed to him. He was a good learner. He said, well, I don't know if I can. I said, can you just do it for a week? Get up at this time. We agreed upon 5:55. It wasn't 6, because 6 can mean 6:15. 5:55 is 5:55. For 1 week, will you do that? Now, don't promise if you won't keep it. Just do it for a day. He said, I'll do it for a week. Is that a commitment? I commit. A week later, did you do it? I did. Congratulations. I commend you for your integrity. Now, will you study when you get up? I can't. My mind is distracted by so many other things. Will you just stay there and stare and look? What happened? I began to read a little. I started to learn a little. Okay, now, can you continue to get up at 5:55 and master this much material this coming week? I think I can. Week later, did you do it? I did it. Congratulations. Step upon step, line upon line, this person gradually developed an internal sense of self-control. He began to apply that to his eating habits, to his working habits. It started to affect his own confidence and his own sense of competency. This began to automatically affect his relationships with other people. He began to get more and more control over his passions. Eventually, he began to be able to focus his desires and his motives on the essence of his work, which was very meaningful type work, and he became extremely powerful and effective. But the key began when he took control of his appetites, in a small way, by making and keeping a promise. I've used that so many times over the years in many different settings, even with myself. Start small. In fact, I have a friend who said, I've learned the key to my life is to write down a promise. And if I write it, I'll always keep it. But if I don't write it, I usually don't, even though I intend to. And he said, so I'm very careful what I write because my honor is at stake. And little by little, this is how a person's honor becomes greater than a person's mood. The four endowments, self-awareness, one excellent way is by the keeping of a journal, of developing that as well as the others, conscience, through educating and obeying it, imagination, through visualizing as clearly, empathically, with as much sensory detail as possible, get a vision, dress rehearse, see it happen in your mind before you try to make it happen in fact, and then make and keep a promise in developing willpower.
It's our experience that most people who really think about their lives have an awareness of these four needs: to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. They also have some awareness that there really are extrinsic, true north principles that govern quality of life. And they also have some awareness of these endowments that are within them: self-awareness, conscience, independent will, creative imagination. Most people want to put people ahead of schedules and to have quality relationships and quality of life and feel peaceful inside and good and competent in their ability to make good decisions in the moment of choice. More often than not, traditional time management gets in the way. The calendars and schedules and third-generation planners keep us focused on the urgent instead of the important. They create guilt when we don't stick to the schedule or check off all the to-dos on a list. They tend to stifle flexibility and spontaneity, and they create a misalignment between what really matters most to us and the way we live our daily lives. It's important to remember that doing more things faster is no substitute for doing the right things. And this is the need for the fourth generation, the generation that helps us to fulfill our basic needs and capacities in a balanced, principle-centered way.